Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, the Doctrine of Creation, Part 6. For more resources from Dr. Craig, go to reasonablefaith.org.
Well, in our lesson, we've been talking about the doctrine of creation, and last time we simply had a sort of review and I think a helpful discussion time of the concept of creation in contrast to the notion of conservation. And you remember last time I argued that a robust biblical doctrine of creation involves commitment to a so-called tensed or dynamic or a theory of time as opposed to a tenseless or static or B theory of time. That is to say, we shouldn't think of time as a part of a four-dimensional space-time block or manifold that just exists in a tenseless way co-eternally with God. Rather, things come into being and go out of being as time passes, and that therefore temporal becoming is a real and objective feature of reality, and creation involves God's literally bringing something into existence which formerly did not exist. Now, the question that I want to raise this morning is, does the doctrine of conservation of the world also commit you to a tense theory of time, or is it consistent with a tenseless view of time? Now, at first blush, it might seem that the tenseless view of time would be much more consistent with the idea of time as a sort of four-dimensional space-time entity. Let's imagine this is the space-time block, and time is, say, the vertical dimension of this block. And we can imagine that events occur at various places in this four-dimensional space-time block. And we can think of God as existing outside space-time and simply maintaining it in existence. He's being causally related to every point in space-time and keeping it in being. And so we might think that on this construal of time, God could indeed be thought to conserve some entity, let's say E, which exists here at, say, T1, until some later time, T2. And so God simply, tenselessly, sustains E in existence from some earlier time to some later time. But I think a moment's reflection reveals this to be problematic. You see, on a tenseless theory of time, it's false that E actually endures from T1 to T2. What you really have is just different slices of E that exist at these different times. So if you have the slice down here, the segment of this stick, E, what exists up here is really something else, E prime, let's call it. It's a different slice. It's sort of like a loaf of bread, where one end of the bread isn't the same as the other end of the bread, but the bread is just sliced up into different slices. And so similarly, on this four-dimensional view of time, it's really false that E endures from some earlier time to some later time. E never, quote-unquote, moves. E is, quote-unquote, just stuck at its location. But it's part of an extended space-time worm, as we might call it, or four-dimensional object, and it's one initial segment of it, and here E prime is a later segment. And these are quite distinct entities. They are not the same at all. So on a tenseless theory of time, God really doesn't conserve E in existence from some earlier time to some later time. We can also see the problem with this notion if we think of some entity that exists only at a certain time, say some entity X, which exists only at T2, it just exists for a single instant. Now, clearly, X depends upon God for its existence, but he doesn't conserve X in being, right? Because X doesn't endure from one moment to another. It only exists at T2. It doesn't exist at any other instant. It is simply something that exists at a single instant. And so even though it depends on God for its existence, God can't really be said to conserve X because X only exists at one instant. Or what about the whole four-dimensional space-time manifold? What about the whole thing? Clearly, this whole thing depends upon God for its existence, and yet God can't really be said to conserve it in being because he doesn't preserve it from one moment to the next. It just exists tenselessly, co-eternally with God. And time is just an internal dimension of this block, but the whole block just exists, in a sense, timelessly with God. And yet, it's clear that God is the source of being of all of these entities. He's the source of being for E and E prime, for X, and for the whole four-dimensional space-time block. Similarly, suppose there are objects that exist but don't exist in time. Like what? Well, say like the number 2, or the set of all odd numbered, 1, 3, 5, and so forth. Or the square root of 9. There might be all sorts of abstract objects that exist timelessly. And a serious doctrine of creation would have to say that these things depend upon God for their existence if they are real. They can't exist independently of God, and yet God can't be said to conserve these in being because they don't exist in time, right? So they can't be preserved from one moment of time to another. And remember, that's how we defined conservation. Conservation is God's acting on some entity to preserve it in existence from an earlier time to a later time. And that would clearly be inapplicable to timeless entities, if there were such things, such as abstract objects like numbers. So it seems to me that what we need here is some third category of how God relates to the world that is different from creation and conservation. What might we call that? Well, let me just invent a term. Why don't we say that God sustains these things in being? And sustenance, we're going to characterize as a different property than conservation or creation. So, God creates things on a tensed theory of time when he brings things into being. He conserves things in being on a tensed theory of time when he preserves something from an earlier time to a later time. But if a tensed less theory of time is true, or if there are timeless objects like numbers, then God neither creates nor conserves them. Rather, I'm saying he sustains them in being. This would be sustenance, another category in addition to creation and conservation. So, how might we define sustaining? Well, how about this? God sustains E if and only if either E exists tenselessly at some time T, or E exists timelessly, and God brings it about that E exists. I'll repeat that. God sustains E if and only if either E exists tenselessly at T, that would be the case of things like X and E and E prime, E exists tenselessly at T, or E exists timelessly. And that would be the case with these abstract mathematical objects that don't exist in time, and God brings it about that E exists. So that's what I am suggesting we mean by sustenance God brings it about that these things exist, but they exist either tenselessly in time or they are timeless. So what that implies is that the very idea of conservation is also committed to a tense theory of time. It's not just creation that commits you to a tense theory of time, but I think conservation also commits you to a tense theory of time. Conservation of a being is necessary if the being is to endure from an earlier time to a later time. If that same being is to exist through time, then it requires God's conservation. By contrast, on a tenseless theory of time, conservation is not only unnecessary, it's excluded. There cannot be any conservation on a tenseless theory of time. Neither is there really creation in a robust sense of the universe. Rather, the proper relationship would be sustenance. God sustains things in being. He sustains the four-dimensional universe in being. He sustains in being everything in it, and he would sustain in being anything that exists timelessly. So what that suggests is that if we do hold to a doctrine of creation and conservation that are, I think, robust biblical doctrines, we're also committed to this tensed view of time, that time is dynamic, temporal becoming is real. We don't exist in just a four-dimensional block universe. Any discussion about that point? Yes, here in the back.
Hey, Bill, just looking at that, thinking of a bad analogy of a playwright in a play.
Yes.
Why couldn't it be said that God created the universe and then he created a plan for the universe?
All right.
And opened the curtains.
Okay, now think about what you just said. He created the universe and then he did something else. That then indicates a temporal relationship.
And okay, so, he created the universe, which included a plan.
Okay, right. He certainly could do that. But in that case, I don't think you have real creation. What you've got is simply God sustaining the universe in being with a beginning to the play or a beginning to the drama. And this analogy that you've used is one that I think C.S. Lewis tried to use, but faultily, in my opinion. Lewis said that God is like the author who is outside the novel or the play. And the novel or the play is what happens in the universe. And God is outside of it. He knows the end from the beginning. He's written the whole thing. The difficulty with that is, you see, the novel and the play then always are co-eternal with God. There's never any point at which God begins to write the novel and brings it into being. Once you say that, then you're going to posit a time above time. You're going to have a second order time. First, there's just God alone. Then he writes the novel and boom, the whole four-dimensional block exists. And then maybe say he's done with the novel and it's just God again or something like that. And that means you have really a higher hyper time and you're just back to the same difficulty again. God then has to still be in time. He would be in this hyper time or second order time. Okay, Tiwan.
If we build this concept from the verse in Hebrew, the universe was formed at God's command, the universe is visible, God's command is invisible. And if we understand that everything is made by God's word, the invisible part.
Yes.
So he finished the creation in 6 days, but his command has not yet finished. His command continues. So the invisible command actually will become visible as human life live out in according his purpose. So it's almost like invisible, God's heaven, the end of time is complete in God's mind, and then His invisible quality are communicated with people of faith, as Hebrew 11 demonstrated. Each person live out their function as if it's a mathematical function of time, and each person has just one value of time, and as they live out their function, they actually bring that invisible factor into visibility, so we are able to see God's plan unfold as it goes.
Yeah. Now the question is, Taewon, if I understand you right, is that unfolding of God's plan that you talk about, is that something that really happens? Does the plan really unfold? Do things really happen? Or is that just an illusion of human consciousness? If you say it really unfolds, then you are agreeing with a tensed view of time. If you say, no, it doesn't really unfold, it just looks like that, like a movie, a film lying in the can, all of the frames are already existing. They're all in the can already. And it just looks like they're happening when it's projected on the screen. But in fact, really, it's all there. The difference between the dynamic and static theory of time is very much like the difference between the film as it lies in the can and all the frames are there, and the movie watched on a screen where there is real becoming that is actually happening. And I think you want to say, I hope, that this plan really does unfold, right?
It does, because as Hebrew 11 lists out all these people, hero of faith, what they are doing is they are making it visible, the stroke, as it unfolds. And what Jesus came, he actually show us how to snap into the equation. He is the equation of the function, and if we believe in Him and learn to snap into equation, we will be able to live out this function God intended. So okay, as each person by faith live out that function, and the picture will unfold with God's purpose in a clear integrated way.
Okay. Anybody else have a comment or question you'd like to raise? Yes, Bruce?
Part of the problem with grabbing a hold of this greased monkey is is a finite mind trying to understand the infinite, right? Favorite cosmological verse is Romans 4:17, that God calls all things as though they are, or the not being as being. So He's not bound by time, although He gives us a time spectrum to work through. There's a series going on with Brian Greene from the based on his book on time and space and these types of things. And they had one episode on the shooting of the arrow. The arrow goes one way, not back the other way towards the archer. And you demonstrate this with that's the way it should be with increasing entropy. So you've got that in time and space that we're locked into, but God in Romans 4:17 supersedes time and space, and I'm not sure we can necessarily come to a way that He does that, but I always look at God operating in the infinite now.
Now Romans 4:17, I think, is an affirmation of creation ex nihilo. It says, God gives life to the dead and calls into existence the things that do not exist. Now that, to me, is an expression of a tensed theory of time. It's not that these things tenselessly exist, and later on they sort of are visible, whereas before you can't see them. God calls them into existence. It says He calls into being the things that do not exist. So I take that, again, to be supportive of this idea that things really do come into being, and therefore this block universe view is theologically unacceptable. Now, you have to be very, very careful, Bruce, in watching these popular scientific programs about time and space. because they are almost overwhelmingly physicalistic and reductionistic. And I think this identification of time's arrow, so to speak, with the direction of increasing entropy is a perfect example of that. At the very most, increasing entropy would just be evidence of the arrow of time, but it wouldn't constitute the arrow of time. There's no reason to treat time in this reductionistic way. Time can exist without the second law of thermodynamics. It can exist without physical space even. Someone mentioned here last time, they're just a series of mental events in a person's stream of consciousness would generate a before and after. So be very critical when you listen to these programs on scientific understandings of time and space, because they are so often reductionistic in a physicalistic way.
I would agree, but I think he was that supported a tense view of time and why we need to have one as a creation, and that this was physical support for such a thing.
You know? Okay. Yes, Jeremy?
Could you speak to where the abstract objects do exist, or maybe how they exist?
Well, they don't exist anywhere, Jeremy, any more than they exist at any time. If there are these things, they're not in space. Remember, this is space and time here. Time is the vertical dimension, and space is these lateral dimensions. So we've repressed one dimension of space because we can't picture it here in this blackboard. But we suppress one dimension of space, and we imagine these two-dimensional spatial planes slicing this four-dimensional, or here, three-dimensional block in the picture. So this is space, this is time, and so if there are these abstract objects like the square root of 9, they don't exist anywhere, and they don't exist at any time. They would just transcend space and time. Now, that's problematic, I think. I personally don't think that these things do exist, but a lot of people do. And so I want to think of how would a doctrine of the world's dependency upon God look from their point of view, even though I don't agree with that point of view. The mainstream Christian position, Jeremy, has been that these sorts of entities exist in God as God's ideas, so that they're not something separate from Him. They are concepts in the mind of God. That has been the mainstream Christian position historically. Yes, Eric?
It would seem to me that regardless of whether you look at a tensed or a untensed theory of time, we still have this hypertime problem, that whether God brings the universe into existence as a four-dimensional space-time block or as this linear progression of events, there still would need to be a, quote, time before time in which God exists by himself before he brings the universe into existence.
Now, let me interrupt at this point. Even if that's the case, Eric, it wouldn't need to be a higher time or a hyper time. It would just be an extension of the same time back before creation. So let's imagine here is, say, the creation event, the Big Bang, and that time goes on from there. The question is, did time begin at the Big Bang? Or, as you suggest, is it the case that, in fact, prior to the Big Bang, there was God, and this just goes back infinitely? Now, I think you can see that here we're not talking about another time dimension. It's just extending the same dimension backwards. To have a higher time dimension, you would have to have the dimensions be at right angles to each other, so that, say, if this is our time t, and here's t1, t2, t3, and so forth, That would have to endure through this hyper time, which is at a right angle to our time. So here would be, say, the Big Bang right here, and here would be the same event, and here's the same event, and this block would just endure through the hyper time. So I think you can see that's very different from just saying, well, time goes back forever just as it goes forward forever. It's not a higher time. It's not a second time dimension. It's just saying there was time before creation. And that's an issue that's very much disputed among philosophers and theologians who think that God is in time. I would say most of them who think that God is in time now probably think that time goes back before creation forever. I don't think that, but I think that's probably what most of them would say. Okay, some other question?
If I understand this model of the tenseless space-time continuum, I think one of the things that I don't understand is how does it account for the causal relationship between events? In other words, if E is a loaf of bread and I decide to eat it at T1, it no longer exists at T2. But if I decide not to eat it, then maybe it still exists at T2, and where does free will come in?
This has been recently a subject of discussion in the open forum on the Reasonable Faith chapter, on the Reasonable Faith website. And I think you're raising an interesting question. You're saying, in what sense can E be the cause of E prime? Because they don't exist at the same time. It seems like causation requires that you would have some kind of influence from one moment to the next, and that doesn't seem to exist here in a sense. I think this is going to depend on what you mean by causation. I think that what the tenseless theorists could say is that E prime is caused by E in something like this sense, that if E didn't exist, or if it hadn't existed, then E prime wouldn't have existed either. Now, the problem is it's not a very good definition of causality, but it does seem like they're going to have to think of causation in a different way, because on this view, things don't really bring things into being. They don't really bring new things into existence.
People make decisions, and decisions have consequences, and that has an impact on what you see inside.
Yeah. You asked about free will. Again, I think what the person could say is that because there isn't any determinism on this from one earlier event to a later one, that it does allow room for free will. And I do think that's right. If there isn't determinism, then that would allow room for free will, even though the future is just as real as the present. Let's see. Well, Drew, we'll take Drew down here, okay?
Yeah, on your diagram, you have this object E, and it looks like E is, on the B theory of time, like a four-dimensional worm, right, that begins at one point, ends at another. Now, is E prime, like the later state, is that a different object?
Yes.
Or is it a different temporal part of the same object?
Both. It's a different temporal part of this whole space-time worm here, okay? But what I've labeled here as E and E prime are different parts of it, like different segments, like a loaf of bread that's sliced into slices. And this is one heel, and that's the other heel. And they're both parts of this whole loaf of bread. But obviously, the one heel is not the same object as the other heel. They are different objects. So E and E prime are different objects. Now, think of what this implies, Drew, if this is supposed to be a person. If this is you, that means that the person, or whatever was the person stage that came into this room an hour ago, isn't the same as the person that's sitting here now. It's just a later stage of this four-dimensional worm, so that nobody endures through time. You're literally not the same person you were a second ago because you're a different object. And that really occasions interesting theological problems for, say, divine judgment. Why should the person who appears before the judgment seat of Christ be blamed or punished or rewarded for what some earlier, quite different person stage did back a long time ago? Why are you being punished for something that somebody else did? And yet that's what it amounts to on this view when persons are these extended four-dimensional objects. Okay, any other comment? Yes, right here.
In 100 AD, was the Apostle John actually looking at future events when he was shown them?
I think that is going to depend on which theory of time you adopt. You could say, if you're a tenseless time theorist, that those events that are happening at the end of the history are actually real, and they exist, and they're just as real as the events that John in AD 100 was experiencing, and that somehow he had a vision of those events. On the tensed theory of time, I think what you would say is, no, those events, he wasn't really seeing them because they don't exist. He was having a foreshadowing of them, a kind of visual image of what would eventually happen, but he wasn't seeing them as they actually exist. And you remember last week, I think it was, that I said that's why I think the metaphor of God's foreseeing the future is very misleading. It implies that God's knowledge of the future is like perception, that he looks ahead somehow and sees what's out there, what's up there. And on a tense theory of time, we shouldn't think of God's foreknowledge of the future on the model of perception, because there isn't anything there to see. Okay, Steve?
First, I think the tensed view is correct. And it also allows for Taiwan's, where they're individual is interacting with God within them once you're reconciled. She says Christ clicks you into being able to talk to God, you know. Uh-huh. In a certain sense, everybody is, because the scripture says, if God withdrew his spirit, all flesh would die, man and animal. But taking a tense view, you could actually say God actually joined creation, not in the sense of the visible, which is temporary, but just like we have a spiritual body that's not seen and it's eternal. And so maybe the things in Revelation aren't the end of time, but a judgment, a refreshing.
Well, certainly God joins in creation in the incarnation, doesn't he? Which is a nice segue to this Christmas time of year. In the incarnation, we believe that the second person of the Trinity took on a human nature and actually entered into our physical space-time universe, so that he actually existed at a point in time in history in his human nature. And so in that sense, God certainly does join in creation in not only creating the universe, but actually entering into it in the person of Christ by assuming a human nature. Well, I think that with that, we'll draw to a close. And then next week, when we meet, we'll look more closely at the doctrine of conservation with regard to the doctrine of concurrence. Does God cause everything that happens in the universe? Or does he simply allow things to happen to be caused, but he's not really the cause himself? And we'll examine how God concurs with the operations of secondary causes in the universe to bring about everything that happens. So we'll see you then next Sunday.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.